In 5, 4, 3, 2.
Defying the laws of the universe, traveling across the globe, giving up life and liberty, finding the real people, finding the truth. This team will stop at nothing to tell your story. Decades in the making. Finding the people behind the ads. Ad Phantom has arrived.
A little too over the top?
Maybe a little.
Whatever, just roll with it.
Alright, here we go.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Ryan.
And I'm John.
And welcome to the Ad Phantom Talk Show. We owe all of you a deep apology. That's not really our fault, but we ran into a lot of technical problems this month. In fact, the whole studio system crashed. Yay!
Bum, bum, bum.
So we've been working tirelessly to get everything back up and running. We didn't actually lose previous content, but we did lose a lot of our ability to record and everything has just been a big mess, but we are up and running. Our system has been upgraded, so we're excited about that. Our business wallet is not as excited, but So make sure you buy lots of products at adphantom.com. It's a great website.
It's the holidays. You get great deals through places like Newegg and all
Logitech.
The great sponsors. That's right. All the great sponsors we have. You can definitely use some new kit for those new games that are coming out this Christmas, like Skyrim, which is amazing.
Or Star Wars. Which I do want to do a quick plug. It's been about 3 weeks now. We signed a contract with EA Games. John and I are both very excited about this as gamers.
Super excited.
And we are launching our new live show, which will be announced. Well, we're announcing it now, I guess. So consider it announced. On December 15th, we are launching the live coverage, Ad Phantom's Beyond the Outer Rim, an in-depth look at Star Wars The Old Republic. We are getting early access to the game. You'll be able to watch it video. Don't worry, we're not showing any pictures of John and I because we don't want to scare any of you away. But
we might sneak some in if you ask nicely.
But we will be able to project live images of what we're doing on the game, the whole live events. We're going to be covering that every day until launch, December 20th, and we will cover that as well. And then that show will continue to be a weekly show in addition to the Ad Phantom Talk Show for all you gamers out there and anyone who's interested in the Star Wars The Old Republic. Real excited about that. If you haven't pre-ordered Star Wars, guess what? You can do it from Ad Phantom because we are partnered with them now. If you're looking for a digital copy, along with a couple of other games that are on sale right now, The Sims 3, Need for Speed, Battlefield 3, all of that.
Right.
So we're pretty excited to be with those guys.
For sure. It'll give you a nerd boner.
Done and done. This is why I don't wear pants at all.
That's
Wait,
right.
What?
What? You need the extra room. So it's the holidays, Ryan.
Yeah. So it is the holidays. We got a lot of great deals that will be coming in. Check out Ad Phantom. Make sure to visit it every day because some of the deals we get do only last 24 hours. So make sure to visit that often. Thank you for your continued support at the beginning of November when we did have this problem. We've got a great show coming up on author Glenn Cheney, who I swear has been all over the world. I don't even have to swear. He has been all over the world. One of the first journalists in after the Chernobyl disaster, as well as a lot of in-depth research regarding Thanksgiving. So it's a little bit of a Thanksgiving treat for everybody.
That's right.
Oh, that's enough talking for me. John, what are you doing, Mr. Chef Cook Extreme Man? Is Bobby Flay coming out to do a throwdown with you? Like, what's going on for Thanksgiving?
Definitely not any throwdowns in my house. I try to keep it low-key. I'm doing something real simple. Just some, horseradish mashed potatoes and some prime rib. You see, because I've got
prime
in-laws.
Rib?
Yeah.
Tell us about this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm doing two Thanksgivings, one on Saturday with my immediate family. All my sisters are coming in. They're going to do the whole boring spread. And I was like, my in-laws were like, hey, let's do ham or something. And I was like, prime rib. She was like, yeah, I like that. I'm like, I like the way you think, lady.
That's
why I married
awesome.
Your daughter. Anyway, so yeah, I'm really excited about it. I'm just going to do a classic one. I'm not going to do any of this like Cajun spiced, anything like that.
Yeah.
But, I'm going to just dry rub, marinate it overnight, and then bring it up to temp before I roast it to a perfect 120 degrees.
Are you doing your classic bacon grease mashed potatoes?
I'm actually no. I might do two because I usually like mix the new potatoes with the russet potatoes to get that kind of smooth / chunky mix.
Yeah.
And I peel the russets, but I leave the new potatoes a little bit of skin on it so that everyone gets a little bit of something they like. So if you like creamy, you've got creamy. If you like the more chunks, you got chunks. And I usually do those with like garlic and some fresh herbs and, you know, a quarter cup of bacon fat and two sticks of butter and like a quart of cream. But
while you're on the topic of bacon, I'm gonna hijack your bacon recipe for this.
Scandalous.
I'm gonna hijack it. I gotta tell you why. You know, as you guys know, I've been touting this compendium of chutneys that we reviewed, got the product, love the recipes, lots of great fruits and vegetables that you can turn into different chutneys and preserves and stuff, including some exotic fruits, which, you know, is somewhat nostalgic for me living in Brazil. And this weekend, I decided to try a apple red pepper chutney. It's got a number of different ingredients. Ooh. Great recipe. You can get that, again, it's only $9.95, so it's an awesome recipe book and over 250 pages.
Every time I talk to Ryan, he talks about this cookbook.
It's good. It's awesome. I mean, basically, this is how a chutney works.
I mean, it is autumn. So, I mean, definitely the time to jam and chutney and canned foods.
And the other thing, I'm glad you said jam, because here's the thing. When you say chutney, people get kind of scared because they're like, ooh, Indian food. I can't eat that. It's got too much spice. Basically, all it is a jam with, you know, I mean, it is a jam. It's a jam that's not jarred.
Think of it like freezer jelly, if you've ever made that. It's a similar concept, only less sugar.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's generally very healthy for you. Because you're using fresh ingredients, and basically any chutney is just take all these fresh ingredients, cut them real small, and cook them for an hour with some liquid. That's kind of what a chutney
is.
Absolutely.
They're super healthy. Like if you just want to do like a poached chicken or a grilled chicken, you can put a, you know, really high quality chutney over it and it'll make you happy.
In fact, for Thanksgiving, I'm going to be doing a cranberry chutney, so I'll have to let you know how that turns out.
I'm excited.
It's got apple and cranberry. It's kind of like a cran apple thing.
Does it have nuts in it?
I think it does. I might throw some in just for you.
You get me.
So what I did with bacon is I made that chutney. I took chicken breast and, you know, almost cut it not quite in half, but made a little pocket. I stuffed it with the cream cheese, olive, garlic mix that I had made myself, put it in the chicken, wrapped it in bacon, baked it, and then put a little bit of chutney on the top. That sweet, sour, you know, salty, it was just, it was a great blend. This recipe will probably not end up on the website, mainly because I don't measure anything. This is true.
Sorry.
So you got to listen to the show over and over if you really want to get the recipes.
Right.
I don't measure anything, so I'll put a picture up there.
You can email our info people. What's their email address? Bother them about the recipes.
The production at adphantom.com. They'll be so angry.
Let our production assistants worry about that.
they'll kill us.
They'll email you. No, they won't. I'm just kidding. Don't do that.
Don't say that. Just tell them about show ideas.
Just let them know
a show idea. Let's put our recipes on the website. you might see a picture, but you probably will get the recipe because I don't measure anything. I mean, that's my challenge. I'm like, I don't know.
But
if you can't
figure out how to smush some olives into some cream cheese with some herbs, then you don't deserve to know how to cook.
I agree. Well, we do want to get to our show before we ramble too much. Glenn Cheney, great information on Thanksgiving. And then following him is our great musical guest. We'll be right back after this quick commercial.
Yeah, it should be pretty good. But you don't have to take my word for it. Ba-da-bum.
Hey, John, you know what time of year it is?
The holidays.
Yes, and you know what comes during the holidays?
Presents.
Yep, and what are the best presents for nerdy folks like us? Video games.
That's right.
AdVandom is excited to announce that we are now partnered with EA Games and their digital download Origin. So now, through AdVandom, you are able to get some of the great games like Battlefield 3 that just came out and Star Wars The Old Republic that's coming out this Christmas.
That's right, and with this, we'll be able to bring you some exclusive content through a new show that we're about to produce.
AdVandom will be producing a live coverage show of the early access of Star Wars The Old Republic coming next month.
That's right. We're really excited to bring you this awesome content. We're proud of the fact that we're able to sponsor with such great companies like EA Games. So if you buy through adphantom.com, you're not only supporting us, but you're also able to give us the opportunity to give you better access and better deals on some games through our website.
Adphantom.com, finding the people behind the ads.
Welcome back, everyone. Today we have with us a great author. His name is Glenn Chaney. Ryan, would you tell us a little about him?
Yeah, absolutely. Glenn is a very talented writer with 60 years in the business. He has authored over 20 books, both nonfiction and fiction, written hundreds of articles, and the occasional short story. His passions for truth and love of culture has taken him all over the globe, with extensive experience in the Amazonas of Brazil. Married to a Brazilian and father to a history teacher, Glenn is also a beekeeper who continues to actively participate in his community in a variety of roles, including a 5-year stint as an EMT, services on the boards of finance, a selectman, and of the library, and a host of other positions in the local community. He officially lives in Hanover, Connecticut, but you frequently find him abroad doing research for his writing. I feel confident in saying that he was also probably a candidate for the role as the most interesting man in the world. Glenn, é um grande prazer poder conversar contigo hoje.
Igualmente. Obrigado.
No, ladies and gentlemen, that was not Spanish. It is Portuguese, the national language of Brazil.
So, Glenn, reading up on you, you've spent a lot of time in Brazil. When was your first visit?
This is interesting. Right after I got out of college, I worked full-time all the way through college. And when I was done, I was ready to retire. And I just started hitchhiking. This is 1974. And I crossed the United States and turned left and went down through Central America and down the Andes, and I ran out of money in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and so that's where I stayed.
Wow. I can't even imagine hitchhiking through Central America right now. Tell us a little bit about some of the encounters that you had there.
There are about a million of them, and it wasn't unsafe. I never got held up or robbed. In fact, in all my travels and all the raunchiest places in the world, I've never been robbed or beaten up or anything, although I expected that, but the people were very, very friendly, in fact. Well, I'll mention something that just occurred to me a couple of days ago. I was in Mexico and hanging out in this marketplace and talking to some people who had a little booth there selling vegetables or something. And they, unbeknownst to me, passed a hat around and collected a bunch of coins from all the other people in the market, so, you know, to help me on my journey.
Huh. So you said you ended up in Sao Paulo because that's when your money ran out.
That's basically, yeah, I blew into town with enough money for a pensão, a little boarding house for about a month. And I'll tell you, I was literally down to 10 cents in my pocket when I finally found somewhere to work.
Oh, wow. So what was your first impression of Sao Paulo?
Oh, well, you know, big city. I'm a country boy. Sao Paulo is a big place. And rather incredibly, I ended up in a boarding house right next to Avenida Paulista, the big, you know, main drag through the middle of Sao Paulo. Well, I was just shocked. I had forgotten Brazil was there, like most people. I'd forgotten that they speak Portuguese there. And I found out, you know, I was surprised that there are musicians there other than Sergio Mendes. And it really impressed me. A lot of nice people there.
How long did you stay in Sao Paulo?
I was there, I think, about a year and a half. Well, I was teaching English in various, schools, and got the brilliant idea of writing a novel. And my father said that it was a publisher who wanted to read it or something. And so I flew right back home and shouldn't have. I should have just kept traveling. That would have been a better life than what unfolded.
So what was it about Brazil that kind of kept you there and drew you back?
Oh, well, back in the States, I was teaching English at University of Bridgeport, and I met a Brazilian girl, and we later decided to get married, and we got married in Brazil after I took a little tour through Africa and almost died. And then we lived in Brazil for, I don't know, another year and a half, I guess, and we came back to the States, and I had a little job in New York for 2 years. It was just awful, and I went kind of nuts, and so we bought a banana farm, but down in Brazil again, and we went back and lived on a banana farm for a year.
That job must have been pretty bad. Buy a banana farm.
Public relations in New York. You just can't imagine.
I'm sure. So, that I have dreams like that. Just, hey, maybe we should go buy a banana farm in Brazil, Ryan, and just get away from everything.
John is implying that we're a couple, and yet we are not. There's a lot of information right in there. So you left Sao Paulo to come back to the States. How long did you stay in the States before becoming a public relations guy in New York?
Oh, well, I was in the States for, I was teaching English at the University of Bridgeport for a couple of years back in the States. And then I went to Brazil for a year and a half. And then I came back and did the public relations.
What years were those?
The kind of
table point of view.
Okay, what was it? I came back to the States in 76, went back to Brazil in 78, came back to the States in like 80 and worked on a master's degree and then worked in New York 84, 85 and then went back to Brazil in 85, and came back to the States in 87, 88.
So you said that you were in North Africa, and I know from your works it read about you crossing the Sahara, and you just mentioned almost dying. So tell us a little bit about that trip.
Oh, well, all right. Yeah, it was rather difficult.
Or vacation, right? Tell us about your vacation in North Africa.
No, this was work. This was another one of my more brilliant ideas. I was going to go teach English in the Ivory Coast. I had met some people from there, and they were really nice. And I thought, I think I'll go to the Ivory Coast. But the cheapest plane ticket was to Lisbon, so I went there. And, the map showed a paved highway across the Sahara, and I figured there's a bus or hitchhike or something. And I caught a ride with this French kid and this old Peugeot, 19-year-old Peugeot. And there was no asphalt, no road at all. It was just across the sand for like 3 weeks, and I really got weakened by that. And then I got sick later on, and I thought it was malaria, and I took a big dose of malaria medicine, which is what you're supposed to do when you get malaria, but it wasn't malaria, and so my heart stopped.
Oh, man.
And I got this terrible fever and horrendous diarrhea, and I really thought, and my eyes crossed, and this is in Ouagadougou, which is just a lousy place to have your eyes crossed, because they're open sewers, and you got to walk across them on these little boards.
Oh, man.
And I didn't have enough money to get home. It was really awful.
How long did you stay in Africa?
Oh, that all that happened in like 3 months.
And so then after getting really sick, do you just hightail it out of there, or?
Yeah, I had to go to the embassy and borrow some money, and then I hightailed it out of there, yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow. And then where did you go after that?
Oh, went back to the States and hung out for a while, and then decided to go to Brazil and get married.
So just so that I've got my timetable straight, you went to Brazil, got married, came back, got your master's, New York, and then went down to the banana farm, right?
That's right. And in fact, it wasn't quite as crazy as just being a banana farm. The university there had invited me. They said, we need to hire 7 English teachers here in the next year. And, there I was with several books published and a master's degree. And I showed up and they said, oh, we forgot. Your diploma isn't valid in Brazil. So you can't teach. So incredibly enough, I had to get a master's degree in English in Brazil so I could teach English. Being one of the better students in the class, of course, I got a scholarship that paid 80% of a professor's salary. It's a crazy country, Brazil. It's really crazy.
Yeah, it is. Definitely. So where was this banana farm located? What state in Brazil?
Oh, a wonderful state called Minas Gerais. It's very mountainous, almost alpine state.
Land of cheese.
Land of cheese. That's right. Cheese and milk. A lot of cows and rugged people and good food. And this is like the cradle of Brazilian culture. It came out of Minas Gerais. That's where the gold was back in the 17th century.
Right.
18th century.
Let's talk a little bit about that food. I'm intrigued by the meat and the cheeses. And so what are some kind of the traditional Brazilian dishes that you long for as now that you're in America?
Oh, yeah. Well, fortunately, my wife, who is Brazilian, I guess I've already mentioned that, she's a very good cook. And I like the food of Minas Gerais. I like the feijoada.
Can you explain those for those of us that aren't familiar with those dishes?
Yeah, feijoada is interesting, historically interesting. It used to be back in the days of the slaves, they used to, the masters would, get the better parts of a pig, and then they would give the slaves, the tail and the ears and the hooves and all the part that, white people didn't want to eat. And the slaves would cook it up in black beans, and it turned out that tasted a whole lot better. Or at least tasted pretty good. So that's what a feijoada is. It's all these different cuts of a pig and sometimes some corned beef in there. And they just cook it for a long time, and it's really good.
As our audience knows, I also lived in Brazil for a little bit, and feijoada is one of my favorite dishes. I found that when I was there that there was poor man's feijoada, which was pig parts, and there was rich man's feijoada, which was linguiça, the dried beef and that kind of thing. So I got to ask you, are you more of a rich man's feijoada fan or a poor man's feijoada fan?
I like it both ways. I like to have an ear and there and a tail and, I like the sausage and stuff.
I got to tell our audience here who doesn't, isn't quite as familiar with feijoada, but poor man's feijoada usually has, just like you said, the parts of the pig, ears. I mean, it's not rare to find a hairy part floating around in your dish, and you just kind of, you know, you got to love pork products.
Well, yeah, I mean, culinarily speaking, kind of a little background. I mean, like, you know, people don't realize it, but, you know, all that collagen and those knuckles and those bones, I mean, that's what's in those broths and soups and stocks. And when you get a really good fresh soup or you really good stock from a restaurant, you know, I mean, that's what's in it. You know, it's roasted bones and roasted anything that has a lot of that connective tissue, that collagen. It gives you that kind of that smooth flavor on your tongue. Mm-hmm. And so I think everyone loves pig parts. They just don't know it.
It's true. You also had a brief encounter in Ukraine when you were studying about Chernobyl and the effects on the people there. Can you tell us about that?
The United Nations sent me over to St. Petersburg to basically write some articles about a conference they were having there. And I had a 3 or 4 day visa. And during those 3 or 4 days, the Soviet Union collapsed. What a convenient thing to have happen. So I thought, okay, if there's no more Soviet Union, I'm not leaving. And I just got on a train down to Ukraine to look into Chernobyl. At the time, this was 1986. No, I'm sorry. That's when it blew up. This was 1990. And I was, like everybody else, thought maybe 30, 32 people had died in the accident. And I get off the train and through some amazing coincidences, just started meeting all the right people and found out that, you know, they were saying 8,000 people had died and that, you know, another million were going to die eventually. And I just went around just talking to people, a film director, politicians, nuclear engineers, families who would live nearby. In fact, in one incredible interview, I'm talking to this guy, and he said that he worked at the plant. And I thought, oh, that's cool. And he said, yeah, he was there on the day it blew up. And I thought, whoa, that's really cool. And I asked him what his job was, and he said, well, he worked in the control room. He was the guy with his hands on the controls when the whole
thing blew. And what did he have to say?
He was real sorry.
Oh, man.
Seriously, he was very concerned that he had caused the problem, and he hadn't. I've done some, you know, technical studies of the whole thing, and it wasn't his fault. They tried to blame it on him, but they just didn't manage to. It was because they were trying to do an experiment that they hadn't planned right, and just the very nature of this experiment put the plant into an unstable condition, and no matter what he did, the thing was going to blow up.
Wow. So what was the overall sentiment from all these people that you had talked to?
They were pissed. they were very sad, not only about the whole thing happening, but that they were, you know, abused by the Soviets. They were just kind of, they lost everything, and they were shipped down to Kiev and put in some apartment buildings, and they, you know, all of them sick, and you know, they lost all their possessions, and they didn't have any jobs, and people wouldn't talk to them. People wouldn't go near them because they thought they were radioactive, which actually they were for quite a while. And, you know, a lot of people dying, and you know, they were not happy about the situation.
What kind of impact did this have on you?
Oh, I was crying all the time. It was just awful. Just listening to these people. I mean, people sitting, I was literally the first foreign journalist who could go in there and, you know, people could talk to openly. And they were just so happy that I was there, and they would tell me these stories, and they'd start crying, and I'd start crying, and it was rough. And there was no food around. There were no restaurants, no supermarkets, nothing. I just had to, you know, I'd go interview somebody, and they'd bring out what little food they had, and we'd have a little something to eat and a lot of vodka.
This is this experience and all this is described in your book.
The title is Journey to Chernobyl, Encounters in a Radioactive Zone, and you can get it in bookstores or Amazon, that kind of thing.
Such a cool story. We'd love to hear a little bit more. We're going to take a really quick break, and we'll be back in a few moments with more from Glenn Chaney.
All right, guys, my name is Chris, and I've got a couple product reviews here for you today. The first one of which is SendGrid. It is a cloud-based infrastructure for emailing. We looked at this, and the website is actually pretty straightforward and to the point. The overall feel is very comfortable and easygoing.
Can I navigate through it pretty simply?
Definitely, dude. I mean, and not only on top of that, but the pricing on this is so awesome. Very inexpensive, the light version being only 10 cents per 1,000 emails you send.
10 cents? Did I hear you right?
Yeah. $0.10. And yes, Ryan, I remember you can buy actually gum back in your day for that price, right?
No. I'm not that old. And in fact, I don't think you can ever buy anything for 10 cents. Not even the little gumballs at the machine.
No, I think those are 25 cents these days.
But at least I know that I can send emails for 10 cents. 1,000 emails for 10 cents through Sanger.
Thousands. Yes, 1,000 emails for 10 cents. And the customer service on this, definitely another 5-star rating on this. It's got email. It's got phone support. It's got a ticket system and training documents and
wow.
A feature request section so you can actually get features added that you want.
Well, that's awesome. So what did you say we gave this for stars overall?
Overall, this thing received one of our first 5 for 5 ratings.
Oh, excellent. So I guess that means it's highly recommended.
Highly recommended.
Excellent. All right, what else we got for us?
Second up on the list is BH Cosmetics. And before I even get started, don't get any wrong ideas. So we actually had one of our female reviewers review this, not me. And I actually had my wife look at it too, so I had a personal opinion of someone I knew. And in her opinion, BH Cosmetics is the sh**.
See, ladies and gentlemen, Chris is new to the Ad Phantom team. We're really glad to have him, mainly because, as you just saw, he's got kind of a no BS type attitude about it. So if he's going to be reviewing something and telling you how it is, he's really telling you how it is. There's not much sugarcoating when it comes to Chris's reviews or the reviews that he oversees on AdPhantom.com. So did you try any of these products yourself, Chris?
Or? No, but my 3-year-old son did. He's got a fascination with my wife's product. So,
oh, dear.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, I was a little disappointed that he used the BH Cosmetics stuff because this isn't your normal cheap from the dollar store crappy stuff.
Okay.
This, we gave it a 4 rating on value because it's not the cheap stuff, but the prices are actually better than average for the high-end material.
Excellent. So and what about customer service with them?
Customer service is what I was just getting to. 2 different mailing addresses, one for their US location and one for their Europe location, as well as a few email addresses so that we can get in contact with them however you want and an ordering phone line.
Excellent. All right, so this one recommended as well?
It is recommended. This one actually got a 4.8 stars out of 5.
All right, sounds pretty good. Well, thank you very much, Chris, for their product reviews. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back.
Welcome back, everyone. Again with us, we have author Glenn Chaney.
Glenn, your nonfiction writing is rooted in firm history, but is often related to recent events. So what made you decide to research and write about Thanksgiving?
I was in church one day, which is not something I would normally do, but I happened to be right before Thanksgiving, and the minister was up there talking about, you know, how, you know, half these people had died over the winter. They spent the winter on the boat, and, you know, everybody was so sick they couldn't even carry the dead into shore, so they'd be lying there on this, you know, this underdeck on the ship and, you know, next to dead people. They were all in there shoulder to shoulder. I mean, it was packed. And I just couldn't imagine spending all winter lying next to people who had were dead of the same things that I had the symptoms of. And it occurred to me that I didn't know anything about the Pilgrims. I hadn't heard about the Pilgrims since I was in the 4th or 5th grade. So I went out to get a book on it, and this is like 10 years ago, and there was no book about the Pilgrims, incredibly enough. And I thought, you know, about that first year anyway. So I thought, I guess I can plug that little gap in American literature. I thought I could do it in about 3 months. I figured Pilgrims, plenty of information, not a complicated story, but it just, every time I'd learn something, and it was all new to me, every time I'd learn something, I'd have to find out the facts behind that. And it ended up taking me 10 years.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Can you go ahead and give us a detailed history of the Pilgrim's journey to America? You talked about the boat, so tell us that. Start from where they came from and then lead us kind of through that year.
All right. Well, let's see. How far back do we have to go?
As far back as you think that people don't recognize, because I think you got a great point. There's not a whole lot about them. And so what everybody thinks about is the Pilgrims coming together and sharing corn and everything working out, and they're all thankful for everything. But we all know there's a whole lot more to that, and it started really early on. So why don't you start with the first thing that you thought was impactful as to convincing these people that they need to move?
All right. Good point. So the book very actually starts out, how far back do we have to go to figure out why these people shipped off to, you know, the New World in 1620? And I had to back up to 1488.
Wow.
Ferdinand and Isabel down in Spain, and they wanted their daughter, Catarina, to marry the prince or a king in Spain for political reasons, and she ended up being the wife of Henry VIII, and he wanted to divorce her, and he couldn't, so the king started his own church, and the Church of England, and years later, these people who... you know, Catholics weren't very popular back then. The Pope was the Antichrist, and certain people thought the Church of England was the same thing. And so this group called Separatists formed a very small, illegal underground church, and they felt they just had to separate from the Church of England, that the Church of England was so corrupt there, they had to separate from it. So they went to Holland. That's the first place they went. And that didn't work out too well. There was too much religious freedom there, and their kids were hanging out with, you know, Jews and Catholics and Arminians and all these, you know, weird religions. So they, and then King James was actually giving them trouble even while they were in Holland. So they decided they just had to go to the other side of the ocean. So off they went. And it was kind of a joint venture.
Around what year was that?
This is 1620 when they're going to shove off. So off they go in two ships, and one ship leaked too much, so it had to go back, and they packed everybody or most of the people into the big... All right, this was a joint venture. Some of the people were there for those religious reasons, those separatists, but a bunch of them were in it for the money, or rather they just wanted to own a piece of land, which you couldn't do in England at that time.
Right.
So really the majority of the people on the ship were... you know, entrepreneurs or just people who wanted to get ahead in life or wanted a better life. And off they went, and they there were delays and problems, and the contract got all screwed up about who was going to pay for what. And, you know, there were investors in England who were financing the whole thing, and it got delayed, and they didn't leave until September. And they were supposed to go to Virginia, but they kind of missed. They came pretty close. They hit just south of Cape Cod.
Right, right.
And they decided to go up inside of Cape Cod to kind of hunker down for the night. And for some reason, they decided to stay there. Nobody knows why, but they decided, enough, this is the place. Except, boy, when you think about it, Cape Cod's a lousy place to try to move into, you know, in beginning of November, middle of November. There was all snow on the ground.
I guess when you're tired of being on the ship, though, I mean, nothing is going to convince you otherwise, right?
Yeah, they'd been on this ship since June, and it was packed in there. There was an area not much bigger than a couple of, you know, living rooms, and they were 102 people in there with some farm animals and a sailing ship and a bunch of cannons and all their carry-on luggage, and there was barely enough room for each person to lie down without being on top of somebody else.
Wow.
And, you know, no bathrooms, no portholes. It was just horrendous. And they all got seasick, if you can just imagine. So anyway, they pull into Cape Cod, and they can't really find a place to live. The ground's frozen, and so they're just hanging out in the ship all winter in this dank, you know, cold, wet underdeck all winter long, and they start dying, and they would take them into shore when, as soon as they got strong enough, and they'd bury them in the sand. They didn't put a cross on them or anything like that. They didn't want the Indians to know how many people were dying. And finally, spring comes along, and they find a nice place to set up a village, and it's right there. And oddly enough, the place was already called Plymouth. An earlier explorer had named it Plymouth. And it was interesting because the last place they had left from England was called Plymouth. Coincidence.
Maybe that's why they stayed.
Well, yeah, it kind of seemed perfect. As for the Plymouth Rock, there's no evidence that they ever set foot on it, but it seems kind of logical. It was right there at the mouth of this little brook that was coming down and where they were going to stay. And I guess, you know, these boats couldn't go right up onto this little sailboat they had, for little rowing sailboat that they would go into shore in. They had to wade into shore, which means every time they went into shore, they were, you know, cold and wet from the waist down.
Yeah.
But I guess if there was a nice rock there, they probably got out on a rock. So it's quite likely they did step on it, if you ask me. But there's no proof of it. There's no evidence. There isn't even evidence that the rock was there at the time. It's been moved around a lot and hauled up into town and hauled back down, and it broke. And there's a whole big history of the rock.
Right. So spring comes along, and they've lost a lot of their people.
Yeah, they've lost half their people, and they're, you know, just trying to set up a little village there, and all of a sudden this Indian comes walking out of the woods, and he says, "Welcome, Englishman," in English, which must have surprised them to say the least.
Yeah, I say.
Yeah. But and that wasn't even the famous Squanto that you may remember from back in the fourth grade.
Right.
He was a pal of Squanto, and he went and got Squanto. Squanto had already been across the Atlantic Ocean four times before the Mayflower got there. And he spoke fluent English. He knew Europe. He had been captured as a young man, as a boy, a teenager, I guess, and taken to Spain and sold as a slave, and then somehow got out of that situation and turned up in England and lived there for several years. And so he learned very good English. So that first Indian who walked up, first he says, "Welcome, Englishman." And within a few seconds after that, he asked them if they had any beer. Which they didn't. They had run out of beer by that point. They were kind of upset about that because they were living off of beer. That was a staple. They gave it to babies. They had it for breakfast. These guys were tromping around.
Well, it was clean. It was clean. That's why.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it had all kinds of great amount of calories. And I mean, that's why it was invented, so that people could fast for long periods of time. We'll go into that later. Yes. Sorry, I'm a food nerd. So
that's all right. No, I make my own beer, and this is why.
I was going to ask about the honey. We can talk about that a little later.
All right. So where were we? All right. So
they meet with Squanto.
The ropes, and they meet the chief of the local tribe there. Oh, so it turns out, okay, so Squanto comes back after being in Europe, and his family lived at, his tribe was there in Plymouth, and he got back, and they were all dead.
Oh, wow.
Every single one of them, his whole family, dead or gone anyway. And in fact, when the pilgrims got there, there were these old houses all falling down because everybody had left. They found there was a plague and everybody died. And Squanto was the only survivor because he hadn't been there. But that was kind of a stroke of luck there. Or, anybody of religious leaning would call it a miracle. These pilgrims landed in the, one spot in the New World that nobody wanted. They didn't have to kill anybody. They didn't have to buy the land. The other Indians thought the land was, cursed because everybody there had died. Right. So the pilgrims moved right in, and nobody cared.
And so this image that has been commercialized of Indians and pilgrims sitting at a table and having a turkey, can you tell us a little bit about, what is the event that we mark as Thanksgiving?
Yeah, we know very, very little about it. We have one paragraph that was written in a letter that somebody sent back to England. And we do know what happened. There was this big party. At the time, there were only, I think, three adult women alive at that time and a couple of teenage girls.
Oh.
And I guess they were going to have, we don't really know, but they were going to have, the typical autumn feast that, farming people will have and give thanks to God and all that stuff. And I guess some Indians came along and saw it was a party, and they said, "Hey, we got some, we'll go get some dead deer." And they brought in some deer and 140 braves and their women and children. And there it was, Thanksgiving. There were like 140 people there, and it lasted 3 days. And I just can't imagine how they were communicating with each other, because they didn't speak each other's languages. And I'll bet the women were all working together, and I'll bet they were trading recipes. And
I bet Squanto was very busy translating what was happening. So everybody was can you tell her this? Can you tell her this?
And if his friend knew English, I'm sure there was, the younger ones might have known a little bit more than some of the older ones. But I guess it's all speculation since we don't have much recorded. My question is, so through 3 days, they're having this huge feast and they're partying. And we have a paragraph on it. Is that what you said?
Yep.
It's interesting.
Basically, they don't mention turkey. They mention that they shot enough fowl to last them for a long, long time, and that they were very thankful for the event. And there were no details about what they ate. We can just kind of surmise what they ate and what they didn't eat. Probably turkey was the fowl. They had cranberries, but no cranberry sauce because they didn't have any sugar. The Indians didn't have shirts on. It must have just driven these people crazy. I mean.
Since we only have a paragraph, that's probably why there are so many common misconceptions and everything. What would you like to clear up that people maybe think is part of Thanksgiving but really doesn't have anything to do with it?
I'll tell you, the big misconception is because it's not taught in schools anymore. After the fourth or fifth grade, you don't hear about the pilgrims anymore. So everybody kind of has this image of the pilgrims as being little cartoon characters with a smiling little turkey and a happy little Indian with a feather in the back of his head, and they're all getting along just fine. And they kind of leave out the part about these pilgrims had seen, half their people die in a few previous months, and they had started from scratch, and here it is fall, and they've got this bounty of food. And these were not You know, these were not superheroes. This wasn't Batman and Captain America, you know, settling America. These were just plain, these were factory workers. They didn't even know about farming, a lot of them. And they were just plain middle-class people. They didn't know what they were. There wasn't a rich man among them. And they just worked really hard and helped each other and pulled themselves up by their bootstraps.
You know, one of the things that I find to be the most amazing and interesting about the story, the true story is, and even in the modern commercialization of it, is the peace that existed. This to me is just very shocking, because how many times do we read in history of, you know, two opposing people with different colored skin, different types of clothing that aren't even able to communicate with the same language? Okay, now we have to kill each other because we're different. Maybe that's why it's so celebrated, is because there's so much peace involved in the story. That's always been kind of amazing to me.
That is exactly right, and a very astute observation, because this is a really unique situation where these people got along. There was a key moment. All right, so they had their little village set up, and they'd met that first Indian who spoke a little English, and he went to get the chief and, you know, to come meet them. And so the chief and a whole bunch of his braves come over the hill, and the pilgrims are like, okay, what do we do now? Big decision point here. And we don't know what they did exactly. We don't know what the discussion was, but I just imagine that there was some George Bush type there saying, maybe we should do a peremptory shot and let them know that we're not afraid and that we've got, we can shoot, the, you know. But Miles Standish, who was their military leader, I think it was him who said, no, let's walk out there, a few of us, and we'll just walk out. And the Indians were showing their bows. They were making threatening gestures, too. Miles Standish said, no, let's go out there and put our weapons down on the ground and see what happens. Let's make that gesture. Very, very Christian thing to do. Very, you know, turning the other cheek, taking a chance. And they put their weapons down, and the Indians put their weapons down, and they came together, and they became friends. There were political reasons for them being friends, too. But they trusted each other, and pilgrims never killed an Indian. Indians never killed them. They just got along just fine. Opposed to Jamestown. Jamestown had a whole different experience. First of all, it was a bunch of rich guys, and they got over there, and then they discovered nobody was going to do the work. They were all rich guys. Somebody else do the work. So the first thing they did was try to go out and grab some Indians, and they wanted to show how tough they were, and they almost immediately started capturing Indians and torturing them, and then the Indians would capture the white guys and torture them, and there's killing, and Jamestown went right down the tube, and pretty soon the white guys are starving. And you think about the Thanksgiving that we have here. We celebrate the Plymouth Thanksgiving. We eat turkey. We don't eat each other. We celebrate the values. We celebrate the values that the pilgrims brought over, not the values that those aristocrat adventurers brought to Jamestown. And we are still pilgrims.
Absolutely. And I do agree with you. And like you said, you know, it was the aristocrats and the people that were high and mighty that were the ones who kind of roiled things up pretty good. But
that 1%, they just ruined everything.
Right? The 1%. Occupy Jamestown, I guess, right? what I guess I want to know is, what aspects of Thanksgiving should we be most thankful for based on our new knowledge of this holiday?
Yeah, well, I think we should be thankful that the pilgrims brought over this culture, the seeds of our culture, if you will, and that those seeds sprouted, and that's what our nation became. That we didn't become, I mean, America, the settlement of America was quite different from that of Latin America, which is still lagging behind, you know, economically and socially, because of the way it was settled, because of the type of people that went in there and what their purposes were. Pilgrims came here to stay. They came to plant. They came over as families. They were middle class. They worked hard. They had this tremendous faith, and they were in it for the money. And by God, that's what our country is. And I guess we should be thankful that our culture was based on that rather than many of the other.
And it bloomed from a peaceful encounter.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
No, I like that. I think you make a really good point. Now, one of the things that I'm most thankful for is food, which is which is why I do a podcast and not a video podcast.
We have what they say is great radio faces.
That's right. but I'd like to know a little bit about the common foods of the time, and more specifically, you know, you always hear those stories about how the natives taught the pilgrims how to plant corn corn, but put, I mean, you know, but back to the whole fourth and fifth grade, you see it, and there's the corn and the fish under the corn, and they plant it, and everyone, you know, it's in this kind of utopian society with everyone learning from everyone about how to plant everything. Do you know a little bit about the common foods? I mean, we just touched on a little bit with the fowl and the deer and things like that, but what were the common foods at the time? And then can you inform us if there's any misconceptions about the stories that we were learned as children?
The pilgrims had brought seeds and things, so they had beans and peas. The Indians had corn. England had corn by that time, too. It had been imported from America. In fact, there's a theory that Squanto showed them how to put the fish, you know, bury the fish and plant the corn on top of that. He may have learned that in England. And the English, and the English guys, they weren't farmers. They were factory workers. They didn't know that trick.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, there's not, that's not a known fact, but it's there's a theory out there that it may have happened.
So the theory is that the Native American is teaching the city British people English techniques on horticulture. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. It's kind of an early globalism.
That's spectacular. That's probably my favorite theory I've ever heard.
Yeah, I love that. That's great.
Next to the whole mushrooms are extraterrestrials thing, but we won't go into that now. Another question I had with your beekeeping and things like that. Now, how did they have? I mean, did they bring bees with them or anything like that, or did they have any domestic bees here?
Well, the bees is a good point. There were no honeybees in the Americas when they arrived. I don't know if they knew that and would have enough prescience to bring over bees. At some point, they were brought over from England, the Apis mellifluus. They probably didn't bring them over on that first ship, but eventually they would. Maybe related to that, we also surmise that they had to bring cats. They aren't mentioned. The cat is not mentioned, but all these old ships had a ship's cat. And if they didn't have a cat in there, the rats that were always on a ship would have just eaten everything.
Right.
So, and in fact, wherever civilization has advanced, they always bring cats.
What does that tell you, John?
Score one cat person. The cat people. I don't know.
I want to real quick, ladies and gentlemen, you can read more about Thanksgiving from Glenn's book entitled Thanksgiving. You can find that at adphantom.com as long as a list of his other books. Along those lines of your other books, I do want to plug your work a little bit because I think it's great. And I told John that when I was preparing, I found myself getting off track reading some of your other stuff from your Year in Minas Gerais and et cetera. So what other books do you have out right now that you can tell us a little bit about?
Well, to go back to Brazil, I wrote one called Journey on the Estrada Real, Encounters in the Mountains of Brazil. The Estrada Real was the royal road that the Portuguese put into Brazil in 1697 from Rio inland up to Minas Gerais, where all the gold and diamonds were. And it's like 800 miles long, and it's still there. Little dirt road winding through the mountains, and every once in a while you come to what used to be a magnificent city that was at one point opulent with gold and diamonds and these magnificent churches, and now it's all kind of fallen into disrepair. The economy up there has collapsed because these minerals are gone. So I decided to just walk down that road for a couple of months by myself with a knapsack and just went from village to village. And each time I'd come to a village, I'd drink a lot of cachaça to recover myself.
Cachaça is a cheap alcoholic beverage in Brazil for those who haven't visited there yet.
Yeah, it's kind of a rum and made just simply from sugar cane. And in Minas Gerais, I was told by somebody who knew that there are an estimated 12,000 distilleries.
Wow.
Every little farm's got a still. It's really easy to make this stuff. And every farm's got it, and they make it, and it's just so common and so cheap that, I mean, it's basically free. Sometimes it's, you know, 50 cents a quart or liter, and you go in a restaurant, and there's a bottle there, you just kind of help yourself. So anyway, I drag in each village and drink some cachaça and eat something. And then I would ask, all right, so who's the smartest person in town? Then I'd go find that person and just talk to that person, just to find out what the story of the town was. And little by little, and then start asking people about their histories. I talked to a lot of really old people who went back to the days when there were, it was all mule trains that, communicated between these villages. And basically, I wrote about the people, but also the food and the culture and the geography and the history and everything. And it was just the best 2 months of my life. I'll tell you, every it's like walking through the 19th century. All the food cooked on wood stoves, and the woods brought in on the backs of donkeys, and it was so nice to get all that exercise walking through the mountains and then come into some little village and become everybody's friend inside of a day. It was great. The food.
Excellent. And again, so this is Journey on the Estrada Real, or Real, Encounters in the Mountains of Brazil. You've got a couple others out, like Frankenstein on the Cusp of Something. What's that one about?
That's a novel. It's kind of a literary, or pretends to be literary novel, of a Bildungsroman, a man of some mental instability, kind of hitchhiking back and forth across the country, very lost and very alone and kind of cracking up. And then he gets arrested, and he just, by the quirks of fate, ends up in the jail cell with a three-year-old, and then the two of them escape, and then he really gets nuts.
Interesting. And how about The Passion in an Improper Place?
That's a sleazy little adventure romance of an American family that goes up the Amazon and up a tributary and gets into all kinds of trouble with the Indians and the timber rustlers and the gold miners and the environmentalists. And it kind of deals with all those issues that I had learned about on a trip up there, but in a kind of humorous and spoofy type of way.
Interesting. Well, ladies and gentlemen, to find out more about these books and other works from Glenn Allen Cheney, you can visit adphantom.com and go to the special guest section of our site, and you'll find his biography there. We are running out of time, but I've got just a couple other questions for you. My first one being, with all this experience traveling all over the world, let's take somebody who's got a limited budget. We'll say time isn't an issue, but they've got a limited budget and they'd like to go somewhere that's going to impact them profoundly, that they're going to have an opportunity to see some great culture and really participate in a real way, rather than, you know, I'm not talking about going to Dubai and doing all this type stuff, but the real essence of humanity. Where would you recommend that they go?
Well, I'll tell you, if you have little enough money, it doesn't matter where you go, because you will end up finding those people and that humanity. And, you know, obviously I'm going to recommend Brazil, but I just got back from Africa, and that was an amazing place. And, you know, India, there's so many places in the world. And I'll tell you, the more money you have, the less likely you're going to see the place.
That is some great advice. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, that kind of puts a different spin on it. You know, the less money you have, the more likely you are to travel. I guess that makes a lot of sense. You got a reason to get out of there, I guess, right?
Yeah.
In closing, I guess the most important question is, what are you most thankful for?
Oh, boy. I don't know, to be alive and to be able to think and to be able to get around. And I've got to be thankful that I have an opportunity to travel. It's it just so happens I have tons of frequent flyer mileage. And
I bet.
And I don't know, there's just so much. Thankful for good food.
Glenn, thank you so much for joining us today and telling your story and sharing with us just a small chip of the iceberg on your experiences. Again, we recommend that you visit adphantom.com to find out more about Glenn Cheney, his experiences, his works, his great writing style, and we hope that you get a little bit of opportunity to be extra thankful this year for what you have. We will be right back after this short break with our musical guest.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thanks, Glenn.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Ryan, the other day my friend came up to me and said, John, I love the Ed Phantom Show. What more can I do to support you and your process of this wonderful show?
It's so funny that you say that, John, because I have hundreds, literally hundreds of people asking me every day, how can we support the Ed Phantom Show? Well, ladies and gentlemen, to all our adoring fans out there, this is how you can support Ed Phantom. As you know, we're partnered with iTunes, Newegg, Priceline, Groupon, Logitech, GoDaddy, Barnes & Noble, and MusiciansFriend.com.
Wow. That's a lot of sponsors. What does that mean for them?
Okay, well, what it means, one, is that we've been hard at work and that our show and our website looked great and they wanted to partner with us to bring us great products. So what that means for them is you can go to our website, adphantom.com. At the very bottom, you're going to see each one of these company logos. As you click on them, you're going to be taken to a site on Ad Phantom that has specific exclusive deals that are supplied to us by these partners. Even if we don't have exclusive ones at that time, you can still go to that site and visit some of the information from that particular product. When you click on that, you're going to go to their site, and anything that you would already purchase, musicians out there buying new equipment, if you're into books, you can go Barnes & Noble, if you're just simply buying through iTunes, you're going to be taken to the partner's own website. But by purchasing that product and going to us first, you help support Ad Phantom so that we can bring you great content.
That's pretty awesome. So basically all the person has to do is go to our website and click on the great website that they were already planning on buying products from and just buy through the website. And it costs the same amount as they would do it normally, right?
Absolutely. It doesn't cost anything extra. And on top of that, because of AdFantom's format, we work on promoting small businesses and large corporations. By creating that network of people, we help support the little guy. So you're also going to see your local deals and stuff that maybe is somebody who's just advertising their own product. So basically what it means is if you have a band, if you have a large corporation, a small company, maybe just one little product that you're trying to get some more exposure, you can visit us at AdFantom.com, help support the little guy and the big guy and the musician and the weird guy, and ultimately support AdFantom.
That's right. AdFantom.com. Finding the people behind the ads.
Initially formed in 2008, the Barefoot Movement is a trio of talented musicians from North Carolina and Tennessee whose music successfully melds Americana influences with the invigoration of acoustic modern rock and jazz. Their sound simultaneously captures the rustic beauty of old southern front porch bluegrass while being immediately accessible to the modern era. Based out of Johnson City, Tennessee, the band is made up of Noah Wall on fiddle, Quentin Akers on guitar, and Tommy Norris on mandolin, and they can be seen performing regularly at The Down Home, as well as many other venues across the state. Their debut album, Footwork, was released in June of this year and has been well received. To learn more about the Barefoot Movement and find links to their albums and website, visit AdFantom.com. Special thanks to all our guests and all the staff here at AdFantom. We once again thank you for joining us and hope you enjoyed the show. Are you in a band or have a great show idea? We love feedback, so please visit our website, www.adphantom.com. Leave a comment, become our Facebook fan, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. Also, don't forget to look at our daily product deals. We'll now close with one of our favorite tracks from our musical guest.
Broken downtown, and no lover do I claim. I'm never lonely for my mountain man when those city lights call my name. High on top or way down low, love is a town paved with lonely road. Lonely road.
and Phantom, finding the people behind the ads.